The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You know, there's a few interesting examples of political opposition in Central Europe that, when unified and inclusive around pro-democracy messaging, have actually been effective in winning back elections from illiberal and kind of the far-right populist governments we've seen.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 21st, 2020. Democracies around the world are under stress, with their norms and institutions undermined by authoritarian actors. From Hungary to India and beyond, illiberal or populist governments are weakening the rule of law, the separation of powers, and the integrity of elections. As part of a 2-episode Lawfare podcast series on the state of global democracy, I spoke with Alina Polyakova and Tori Tussig about democracy promotion. Alina Polyakova is the president of the Center for European Policy Analysis, and Tori Tussig is a non-resident fellow at Brookings's Foreign Policy Program and a research director at the Belfer Center at the Harvard Kennedy School. Next Tuesday, we will release a second episode with experts at Freedom House on their annual Freedom in the World report. In today's episode, we discussed the Democracy Playbook, a report by Alina and Tori, along with Brookings experts Norm Eisen, Andrew Keneally, and Susan Cork, outlining strategies that supporters of liberal democracy can implement to prevent and reverse democratic backsliding. We talked about Central and Eastern Europe, the drivers of democratic discontent, and how all of this compares to the situation in the United States. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 524, Alina Polyakova and Tori Tussig on the Democracy Playbook. So this report is actually the second in what is not formally a series, but kind of operates that way. And as the Democracy Playbook alludes right up front, there's this predecessor report that you guys did. So Tori, get us started. Give us a little bit of background on the prior work that led to the creation of this new report.
So it is clear today that we are in what we could call a democratic recession, or a time where democratic momentum has been slowed. And this is particularly clear in what Alina and I saw in the transatlantic space and in Europe and within Central and Eastern Europe, Poland and Hungary and the illiberal regimes that have taken hold there are case in point. And so prior to this report, we worked on the Democracy Playbook. We drafted a report with other colleagues at Brookings that looked at the anatomy of the liberal states. And the idea is that over the last decade or so, the authoritarian or illiberal populist resurgence that we've seen in this region has been a slow burn. And we've seen governments come to power that have embodied an illiberal nature, and that once they've come to power, they have followed a pretty distinct toolkit. We called it the illiberal toolkit, looking at this in our prior report. And this toolkit was comprised of a few very clear tactics we saw these governments using once in power. It was constraining judicial independence, enacting constitutional amendments that constrained independence of the highest courts in their countries. It was going after political opposition. It was clamping down on free media, either by outright buying media organizations or enacting censorship laws. And it was repressing civil society organizations, either by deeming NGOs as foreign agents or as clamping down at the space that civil society organizations operate in. So in instances in Poland and Hungary, lesser so in Czech Republic and Slovakia, Turkey is another case study. We saw this toolkit playing out in pretty distinct and recognizable ways. And so that first report really looked at how democratic backsliding was occurring in these countries and what it looked like from the top down.
And just to follow up on what Tori just said, I think the big question for us when we decided to write that initial report and what led to the Democracy Playbook about a year or so later was this big question of, how do we understand not the move from authoritarianism to democracy, but the backwards move from democracy back to instances of authoritarianism? Because it's not that, we can say a country is either democratic or authoritarian. There's a scale there. And the question is, are there points of intervention that we can then identify if we understand how that process takes place? Where can we then intervene and make changes to kind of set the country or a region on a different direction away from that path towards greater authoritarian autocratic control? And that was really the purpose of that first report, is can we actually plan out the sequencing of how a democratically elected leader who doesn't seem like an authoritarian, Viktor Orban's a great example of this. Viktor Orban, in the early 1990s, was the leader of the democratic liberal movement. And now, of course, he has become associated with what we now call illiberal democracy, which is a term that he uses himself. And so how does that happen? How do you go from someone who is promoting and advocating for liberal democratic values to now really being the poster child for this kind of backsliding that we're talking about? And if we had known this was happening, could we have intervened? And we can talk about who the we is in that conversation.
Well, you get to that very much in the structure of this report. So what is, Alina, a democracy playbook?
So the democracy playbook is exactly the follow-up to that first report. So now that we have a better sense, so we tried to lay out a better sense of how this process happens. How do you go from a democratic state to a country that looks increasingly more and more less free in various ways? And the democracy playbook was the outcome of that. Our idea was to take the huge amount of academic literature, there's tons of academic literature on democracy promotion and people's movements, et cetera, but to really take it and distill it into practical solutions and practical ideas. And the democracy playbook is, we see it as a strategy that we could and want to be useful to people on the ground, because at the end of the day, it is the individuals in these countries at risk that are fighting that fight towards greater freedom, that are resisting these kinds of authoritarian incursions into their society, into their politics, into their economy. And this playbook lays out a set of very concrete strategies based on all the evidence we could find on that, the domestic actors, so civil society organization, investigative journalists, opposition leaders, can use to try to push in a slightly different direction, a push against the kinds of incursions they're seeing into the democratic space. The other piece of this, and maybe Tori can pick up on that already, is that there is a big role, not just for domestic actors, but also international institutions to play here.
So I want to come to the discussion of the domestic and international actors momentarily. But before I do, I want to focus a little bit on what you describe as this gigantic academic literature on democracy promotion. And so, Tori, without going into a literature review, what is the, people are very skeptical of the idea of democracy promotion. There is this literature. What does it say?
Well, as both of you have mentioned, there is a vast literature on how to measure democracy, but also how to bolster it when it is faltering. And it is literature that has been done across not only the academic landscape, but also is being conducted by organizations operating on the ground in these countries that see what democratic backsliding looks like on a day-to-day basis. And what we noticed is that there hadn't been a really inclusive report or book that took all of this new literature into account, really since Gene Sharp's seminal work on From Dictatorship to Democracy in 1994. And if we look at the almost 30 years since, democracy and its momentum looks very different. The literature around the time at the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall was assessing nonviolent civil resistance movements, you know, on the street protests and how that worked to really bring down communist and authoritarian governments. And in the decades since, democratic progress, democratic pushback against the type of illiberal governments that Alina was outlining looks very different. I mean, we now have new actors like social media organizations. We have strengthened international institutions, regional institutions such as the European Union that are playing revitalized roles in this struggle. And so we wanted to take stock of what this new democratic landscape looked like. Who was writing about the democratic landscape as it appears today under these new types of the liberal regimes, and how, as Alina mentioned, domestic and international actors can push back. But the literature is vast, to be sure.
And I will say there's a huge debate. I mean, there's really no consensus as to whether specific kinds of interventions, especially from international actors, and when it comes to democracy promotion, supporting democratic actors on the ground in various countries, works or doesn't work. I mean, it's a huge debate. There are some case studies that show success cases, for example, and there are some that we have the same interventions in different contexts, different country, and the same intervention cannot be as effective. And I think there's also a huge debate on where we are right now in kind of the global democratic movement, you could say. So Tori used this term, and I used the term democratic backslide, democratic recession. But some would make the argument, for example, which I find problematic, is that if we look at the world today and we look at the number of people, just the sheer number of people who live in democracies, it's actually a much larger number than we've ever had before. So as we're all, you know, wringing our hands about democratic backsliding, which is real in some countries, Freedom House ranks kind of the level of democratic development across the world. And we are seeing many countries, especially in Central Eastern Europe, going down that ranking, according to the Freedom House. But at the same time, you know, there is an argument to be made that if you look more globally, we see kind of different trends and patterns.
Okay, so if you're trying to create a playbook, that implies that there are known plays. And if you're drawing on an academic literature that is conflicted, you know, that reflects a debate on basic methodological and measurement questions, how do you distill a playbook from that?
Well, I would like to just add a quick point that I found one of the most fun parts of this project was that we did a series of interviews and we incorporated these types of local actors in our research. And so we spent time in Poland and Czech Republic and Slovakia and elsewhere in Western Europe, talking to people who are on the front lines of these civil society organizations, people who work in the judicial systems, young rising stars in these political systems. And we sat down with them and we talked about what this toolkit could look like in action and what types of strategies they found in their own local context work best. And so we took the evidence and the debates that we were reading about in the academic literature and we tested it and we made it an inclusive process where we were working with on the ground actors to understand how this actually plays out on the ground.
And just to add to that, I mean, Ben, you make a great point. It's a point we really struggled with. You know, there is a huge amount of debate, a huge amount of disagreement, if you look at the global evidence on this particular issue. And so at the end of the day, we had set out with the ambition of writing the democracy playbook for the world, right? But we quickly found that that was going to be impossible. The report's already quite long, and we were going to have to write like volumes, really. So at the end of the day, we decided to concentrate on the countries that we really see on the fence, where there is still you know, a great deal that can be done to set them in a different direction. Also in countries where there's more leverage for the international community. So countries that are integrated into the EU, for example, or into NATO, these institutions have a lot of leverage there to promote and make sure that the democratic backslide doesn't continue. So because of that, we really did look at Central Eastern Europe as the key area of focus, because we see this as one, a critical area for transatlantic security, transatlantic relationship. And we see this as a space where there's still so much that can be done, unlike a country like Russia, for example.
Okay, so for a lot of people, when they see a paper called The Democracy Playbook, Preventing and Reversing Democratic Backsliding, are immediately going to think of the United States, right? And this paper kind of describes a international approach, but it really is focused on Central and Eastern Europe. And I just want to get out there, to what extent is this a metaphor for U.S. domestic politics?
Well, that is a bit of an elephant in the report, I should say. You know, we chose not to focus on the United States because it is really different in so many different ways than any other European country. And, you know, I would make the argument that we are seeing some similar trends. I've studied the rise of far-right political parties and far-right populism in Europe for about 15 years. And long ago, the kinds of trends that we're seeing a little bit now in the United States, we've had in some European countries for decades. But our political system, the two-party system especially, is so different that these kinds of trends manifest themselves in very similar ways. But I think the reality is that all democracies are facing very, very similar challenges and threats, but in both internal and external. But the way those things play out on the ground are pretty different in the U.S. especially versus European countries. So I think at some point we may do something in the U.S., but we weren't quite ready for that yet.
So a reader in, say, a battleground state who is thinking about how to think about the state of U.S. democracy and how imperiled it is should not pick up this report and say, every time I read the name Viktor Orban, I should sub in Donald Trump and I'll have a playbook for, you know, Pennsylvania in the fall.
I would say definitely not. And I mean, the great irony here, of course, is that a lot of our recommendations are focused on the United States because the United States has been such an important actor in promoting democracy across the world. We are one of the largest funders of pro-democracy civil society groups and independent media.
But it's focused on the United States as a foreign policy actor, not focused on U.S. domestic politics.
And
right?
I think if, in your example, Ben, if somebody in Michigan or Pennsylvania picked this up and said, I'm looking for lessons for what's going on here, I think they would need to use some abstract thought. I think there are some general lessons to be learned about how do you conduct, you know, civil resistance, for example? How do you mobilize support? How do you seek allies? So there are lessons to be learned. But again, the context is so different. And like in my view, the U.S. is still very, very much ahead. I mean, we're a democracy, we're the oldest democracy, one of the oldest democracies in the world. If we look at Central Eastern Europe, these countries are very young democracies. And so our institutions in the United States are far, far more enduring and stronger than what we see in these new democratic societies.
In other words, kids, do not try this at home.
Although I have to say, just to push back on this a little bit, I'm constantly struck when I look at the drivers of discontent for democracy in many parts of the world, but particularly in Europe. The drivers are very similar to what we're seeing in the United States. There has been a generation or at least a decade-long decline of citizens' trust in democratic institutions and elections and elected officials that we see in the United States and that we see in Europe. The divides between urban and rural populations, socioeconomic inequality, the compounding effects of the global financial crisis from 2008. These are drivers that we see, I mean, not just in Europe. They're very much drivers of democratic discontent in the United States. And then on the responses side, you know, as I was reading through this report again, when we talk about, you know, citizen power and going to the streets and protesting for rights and ensuring that money doesn't play an outsized role in politics, ensuring that elected officials are accountable to their constituents. I mean, these are in the abstract form, but also in principled form, lessons that the United States should be learning and carrying throughout the next year as we go into the 2020 election and beyond that.
All right. So message from Tory, kids, do try this at home. All right. Let's talk about the contents of the actual playbook, which is divided, as one of you said earlier, into two sections for messages and do's and don'ts for domestic actors in these countries, but also a second section on international actors and how they should play things. So let's talk about domestic actors first. Tory, give us an overview of what you guys are recommending for different domestic actors in countries that have a democratic backsliding issue. Like, what should Hungarian individuals and institutions be doing right now? Radio Free Budapest here. What's the right play?
Well, there are many different actors we can focus on in the domestic context, whether we're looking at Hungary or Poland or elsewhere in Europe. And, you know, to start off with, Alina mentioned that when we're looking at civil resistance movements, this has been a core tenet of key democratic tools that domestic actors should be using to push back on illiberal and authoritarian trends. I would like to just draw out important work that we've seen done from Hardy Merriman, Maria Stephan, Erica Chenoweth, that have focused on the longstanding tenet of nonviolent civil resistance, street protests, in bringing about pro-democratic and anti-corruption leaders. I think when we look at these types of actors, one of the recommendations we put forward is that these movements be as broad and diverse as possible. When we talk about political movements pushing back against corrupt or liberal practices, these activities span the spectrum from political and social ends and bring people in from varying parts of society. I think the worst thing that civil resistance movements can do is seem exclusive and not bring in broad aspects of the population, whether it be urban populations or rural populations. I mean, however you want to divide society, it's important that they be as inclusive and as broad as possible. But we didn't just focus on the civil society actors and the population writ large. We also look at tactics that political opposition, even if not in majority power, but still in government, can use to push back on what might be majoritarian power that are employing in a liberal toolkit. And there's a few interesting examples of political opposition in Central Europe that, when unified and inclusive around pro-democracy messaging, have actually been effective in winning back elections from illiberal and kind of the far right populist governments we've seen. I just want to mention, the opposition parties in Poland in September or October of last year, actually won back the country's Senate from the leading Law and Justice Party because these varied political opposition groups decided that it was important to unify around pro-democracy messaging in order to coalesce party support and take back control from this far-right populist party. And so this is as an overall message, when political opposition parties can unify and kind of avoid splintering, especially within parliamentary systems, these types of gains can occur. So those are just two examples, I think, from the civil society angle, but also from the political opposition angle that we put forward these recommendations for.
Yeah, and to put a finer point on what Tory just said, I would just kind of make two specific points. One is that something you see over and over and over again, which is Tory just outlined, is the fractionalization and divisions on the side of especially what is a center-left opposition. And part of that has resulted in this complete collapse of center-left political parties across the European space. If we look at almost every European country now, the social democratic parties and the labor parties have just lost so much ground. And part of that has to do with this fractionalization that, of course, the ruling party then uses to its advantage. And Russia is the great example of this, because what the Kremlin under Vladimir Putin has been able to do so effectively is continue to drive wedges among various opposition groups in Russia to keep them all in fighting among themselves versus being able to form a proper opposition movement to the regime. And so just having awareness of that, if you're a domestic actor on the ground, is, I think, really, really key. The second point I would make is going local. And this comes up all the time as well, because there obviously is in industrialized or post-industrial societies this rural-urban divide. But one of the key ways in which illiberal leaders have managed to consolidate control is exactly by mobilizing, engaging the rural and sort of the left behind people that have left, that have felt left behind in those societies. And this is something we see in Poland, it's something we see in Hungary and elsewhere. But the response from the opposition groups has still been to focus on urban centers. So you kind of see this disconnect between the strategies being deployed by the authoritarians or the illiberal movements and political groups versus the response by the opposition.
You also address on the domestic side the way that businesses and particularly social media entities should behave. I thought this was a particularly interesting idea in the sense that I guess we don't necessarily think of those when you think of democratic movements or democratic backsliding. So when you think about the democracy playbook, what's the democracy playbook for the private sector and social media outfits?
So I will say that the credit for this insight really goes to our co-author in this report, Norm Eisen, who was ambassador in the Czech Republic on the last administration, and I think actively saw in very much in real life how businesses can have a huge amount of influence in society because they have a lot of leverage over these countries. You know, most of these countries want foreign investment. They want to bring more money. The governments want to show that they're attracting investment because they want to show their economy is growing, et cetera. So private business has a huge amount of leverage to be able to say, well, you know, we will build this new office here, we'll build this new manufacturing plant here, but here's what we need in terms of your commitment to law and order, et cetera. So there's a money, you know, really goes a long way, right? And it's interesting that we don't usually focus on that. So when it comes to private companies, you know, on the social media front, I think it's really interesting that at the same time as we're seeing backsliding in the Central Eastern European countries, some of them more than others, these are also the places where a lot of large tech companies are opening huge offices because there's a huge amount of well-trained, you know, IT tech specialists here and their labor is cheaper and they're, you know, high quality employees. And so when you see those kinds of patterns, like, and this is true for Bulgaria and Romania, and you can run the gamut of all these countries, I think the question is, you know, can these companies be much more active in demanding a certain commitment to values and principles? I mean, most of these are either American or, you know, Western European companies that will say very publicly, certainly, you know, Facebook and others have said very publicly they have a commitment to democratic values and principles, and that's part of their organizational culture and their mission. But that mission should also apply to their business practices. And so that's one of the things that we wanted to draw out in this report as well.
All right, let's talk about international actors. So when we talk about international actors, as you mentioned before, one of the big ones is the United States. And so I want to start with, as you put it earlier, Alina, an elephant in the room, which is whether the United States actually cares about democratic backsliding in some of these countries. President Trump has made very nice and gentle with Viktor Orban, and he has had a lot of nice things to say about Lev Kaczynski in Poland as well. And so I guess my first question is there a premise problem here that, like, a lot of what you guys have written is premised on the idea that the United States actually wants to use a democracy playbook rather than to use a, you know, sort of cozying up to, you know, autocrats and a sort of democracy backsliding playbook. Is the premise wrong?
Yeah, it's, I think one of the most lamentable trends in U.S. foreign policy under the Trump administration has been a lack of attention and commitment to supporting democracy, particularly in Europe. I mean, the United States in previous decades has been the biggest proponent of ensuring that Europe remains whole, prosperous, and at peace. And we have seen a retrenchment of this commitment under the Trump administration. I mean, even under the Obama administration, America's attention was shifting away from Europe, certainly, but that commitment to democratic values and principles was there. And there's a crystallization of this shift in US foreign policy, I think, when you look at the difference between a speech that President Obama gave in Warsaw's Castle Square in 2014 that drew thousands and thousands of people and that stressed the importance of strengthening democracy and remaining, you know, this bright light that Poland was for democratic transformation in previous decades and in 1989. And then you look at the speech that President Trump gave just 3 years later in the same place in Poland, and it was about enhancing, it was a very strange speech, enhancing Western civilization over other cultures. And it had these undertones of anti-Islamic and anti-immigration. And, you know, to people on the ground in Poland who look to the United States as an example and as a friend in strengthening democracy, I think that this was a huge setback. You know, and we saw Secretary Tillerson, you know, then Secretary of State, travel to Poland and say that, you know, Europe, as Poland is one of Europe's oldest democracies, democracy is alive and well here. And it just doesn't jibe with the facts. And as you mentioned, the Trump administration has been equally as friendly toward the Orban government and has really de-emphasized the importance of strengthening the rule of law and judicial independence and freely operating civil society. And that over time has an impact, particularly for younger generations in these countries.
So I think I have a slightly different view on this that may be more controversial. We'll see. On the one hand, so everything that Tory said is correct if we look at kind of the rhetorical level, you know, the level of official speech, speechifying and things like that. But I think certainly at the same time, for example, as we've had these kinds of trends and statements, we've also had RFERL start to reopen their services in Hungary. RFERL, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, generally operated and continues to operate in kind of basically countries where there's not a free media, that are not democratic. And so their decision to go back, they had stopped services there, to go back to Hungary now, I think sends a very clear signal as to what kind of the U.S. view is on some of this. So at the same time, like, I think what we're seeing is a huge disconnect between, and this is not just true of democracy policy and human rights policy in the U.S., it's also been true of other foreign policy issues like Russia, for example, where the president says one thing and the administration continues and the bureaucracy continues to do and churning what it's been doing. So at the same time as we've had these comments about, you know, focusing on Western civilization values versus democracy and human rights, we have had the U.S. government still continue to be involved in funding and providing direct assistance to pro-democracy movements and becoming even more aggressive in terms of presence in some of these countries. So I think it's a more complex picture. And to my mind, I mean, if we think a bit more strategically about should the U.S. policy, how should the United States deal with these countries that are part of the EU? The big question is, well, how should the EU deal with these countries? And that's a whole other kettle of fish. But I think the big question to me is, you know, under the Obama administration, we saw this policy of almost isolationism. Basically, you know, we're not going to talk to you unless you do X, Y, Z. And that didn't actually work. During the Obama years, we saw greater and greater moves towards, quote unquote, a liberal democracy in these countries. And I think this administration came in with the idea, okay, well, that didn't work. I'm not saying it was that rational necessarily, but that didn't work. So can we continue to engage? Because if we don't, you know, the fear is that these countries will drift further and further away. And we can only have influence if we engage.
All right. So with that as premise, what is the democracy playbook for international actors?
So we here also looked at a distinct set of international actors, the United States being one of them. And I think Alina makes a very good point that the United States is not just a unified actor that is represented by the president and an administration. This also involves the U.S. Congress, which I think in recent years has been more vocal at looking at democratic backsliding in Central Europe and in Turkey. Holding hearings on these types of issues is an important way to draw attention to them. I mean, other U.S. actors such as U.S. foundations, NGOs have been good at calling out illiberal tactics when they're seen, calling out, you know, infringements on the rule of law and independent judiciaries. And so at least on the U.S. front, we put forward a range of strategies and tactics that look not just at rhetoric from the administration, but also on the congressional and private sector, NGO and foundation level for helping to bolster the actions of the domestic actors on the ground. As Alina mentioned, a lot of the countries that we focus on are also members of the European Union. We also focus on how the European Union can pursue and strengthen institutional channels for pushing back on democratic retrenchment within their own ranks. This is a tricky issue because when the European Union was expanding in the 1990s and the early 2000s, there were tools that the European Union had at their disposal to help strengthen free institutions within states that wanted to become members of the European Union, steps that accession states had to take on strengthening the rule of law, strengthening accountable institutions, ensuring that there was a viable political opposition. And then once a member of the European Union, this type of leverage kind of disappeared. And so we looked at other types of tools that the EU could pursue. And I'll just mention one for now, but the EU has structural funds at its disposal that countries such as Poland and Hungary are recipients of, and not just Poland and Hungary, but other member states. And we think that the EU should be adopting some sort of rule of law conditionality that ensures how these states are able to receive structural funds. Again, not just for newer states in Central and Eastern Europe, but also for long-tenured member states in Western Europe. There should be a sort of rule of law index whereby states that score higher on the index have greater access to funds. And that is something that the EU, I don't think, uses enough at its disposal right now. So that is the second actor, European Union institutional channels. The third actor, which is not necessarily on the front lines of pushing back of democratic, you know, retrenchment, but is important nonetheless, is NATO. NATO is first and foremost a military organization, but it is also an organization that has within its founding charter a commitment to strengthening free institutions across its member states. And within NATO, you know, most importantly, Poland, Hungary, and Turkey, first and foremost, we've seen a backsliding of democratic institutions that is actually hurting the alliance's core mission of cohesion and trust and interoperability to address shared security challenges. And so this is a platform where we outline a few ideas on how NATO can actually try to make it and help its member states uphold the institutions that are a part of its charter and a part of being part of this military organization.
I think to put it simply, you need carrots and sticks, right? You can't just have all sticks or all carrots. And what that means in reality is that just a very quick, more current example, you know, countries like Poland, especially, are incredibly key allies for the United States when it comes to deterring Russia, for example. And Poland has been, I think, an incredibly vocal partner when it comes to shifting the conversation within the EU, which, as we've seen in some recent moves, especially from France, some countries there are sort of wobbly on the Russia question, and Poland is not. And so as a security partner, they're key for the United States as well. If one of our missions, as this administration has put out in its national security strategy, is to outcompete Russia in this era of geopolitical competition. And so we have to remember that there are a lot of commonalities and shared goals that we still have with these countries. Another example of that is on Huawei. Obviously, the United States is really keen to get our European allies to not allow Huawei into their 5G infrastructure. We have the UK now publicly saying that they will work with Huawei. Poland, on the other hand, has recently said that they will have very strict restrictions. And Romania has done the same, and so has Estonia. So I think there, again, is just a much more complex set of relationships that we have with these places. And so we need to continue to engage in these core areas of national security, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't, and we absolutely should continue to point out when we see problems in rule of law, in corruption, and other issues related to democratic decline.
So we need to wrap up. We've gotten pretty nitty gritty in a bunch of areas, but I want to zoom out. At the end of the day, Alina, is the democracy playbook outplaying the illiberal toolkit? Or, you know, how deep is the crisis of European democracy right now?
So let me answer that sort of through the back door a little bit. I think the big question to my mind that I don't think we ever really got to the bottom of in both of these reports is whether we're really in a crisis of democracy or whether we're in a crisis of liberalism. And we often put these things together and we kind of just say liberal democracy is the style of governance that allows the most freedom for citizens and individuals. But I think what we're seeing in reality is a sort of splintering of these two concepts, where you can have democratically elected leaders who are not necessarily going to promote quote-unquote liberal values with a small L. And that applies to economic policy, applies to cultural policy, and it applies to political tactics as well. And I think to my mind, we have to understand what we're trying to fight here. I know our decision was to really focus on democratic institutions, you know, those checks and balances, judicial independence, free media, a free, fair election system, opposition, political movements and parties in place, because those are things that we can actually kind of see and measure. But I think the big question to me is, you know, what is the EU? You know, what is the Transatlantic Alliance if those liberal ideas are starting to fray away from consensus? And certainly, I think it is true that we do not have consensus on whether this is an alliance based on liberal democratic ideas. I think we still have consensus that it's an alliance based on democratic values. But I think that is still the big question to my mind.
Tory, final thoughts. When the democracy playbook confronts the illiberal toolkit, who prevails?
Well, we've talked about a lot of worrying and negative trends on the podcast today, but I would like to end on an optimistic note, because I do think, despite the backsliding that we're seeing in Europe and even the troubling, you know, trends that we're seeing in the United States, there is hope to be had. Because something that I think we miss in these conversations is that democracy is not some sort of end state to be achieved. I think this is what we missed in the heyday of the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Democracy looked like an end state and something that we would kind of march inevitably towards in this linear line. And it's not true. I mean, democratic momentum across centuries waxes and wanes, and it's a process. It's a process that has to be constantly reinvigorated and revitalized. And I think, you know, pro-democracy actors, small d democracy actors, have taken their eye off the ball. Institutions feel out of touch from people who elect officials to serve them. Trust is declining, but these are solvable problems. And I think that kind of torch, that spirit of 1989, just needs to be passed down to the next generation to be picked up. Younger people today are participating in political systems in different ways. They're looking for new platforms and new ideas. And we're at a transition point, but it's certainly not preordained to be a negative slide toward illiberalism or authoritarianism, but we need to put our eye back on the ball.
The report is The Democracy Playbook, Preventing and Reversing Democratic Backsliding. It is by Norm Eisen, Andrew Keneally, Susan Cork, and our guests today, Tory Tussig and Alina Polyakova. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, and nowhere is that more visible than when we have Brookings scholars on the podcast talking about Brookings reports. You should do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast, spread the word around, share it on social media, give us a review wherever you found us. You should buy Lawfare swag at thelawfarestore.com. You should thank Jacob Schultz and Michaela Fogel, who were the audio engineers on this episode. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. I'm Benjamin Wittes, and once again, thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.